This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Welcome to Radio Parallax. Joining me is my sound engineer, Edward McMillan. On last week's show, we mentioned that it was the 30th anniversary of Watergate, and headlines in the interim make me think that sometimes the more things change, the more they stay the same. In the wake of Watergate, the FBI investigated itself and concluded that it had done a good job, prompting comedian Chevy Chase, then working for, I believe, the National Lampoon Radio Hour, to simulate the old bullhorn scene from the old crime movies. All right, I know I'm in there. If I don't come out with my hands up, I'm coming in after me. Well, 30 years later, the House and Senate Intelligence Committee, after listening to the FBI and CIA critique their own performance in the matter of warnings regarding 9/11, decided that there was no smoking gun, nothing that could have been done to prevent the disaster. And all I can say to that is, if I don't come out with my hands up, I'm coming in after me. Now, comedian Will Durst is fond of saying that you just can't make this stuff up after looking at the headlines. And here's a little item that reminds me of that statement that came out of the Bee a few days ago. 9/11, a lobbying windfall. New York City businesses still recovering from the terrorist attacks in the World Trade Center are hiring Washington lobbyists to help tap into federal aid flowing from Capitol Hill. Jim Albertine, president of the American League of Lobbyists, said September 11th is, quote, provided for new business opportunities, speaking very frankly, end quote. Joining us now on the phone to take up where we left off last week is our Hollywood correspondent, David Rosenblum. David, you have some news for us?
Well, Doug, you know, I'm very proud to say that I actually have an amazing pair of actors, real thespians, who are going to get a chance to shine for the very first time, and I'm very excited to represent them directly this week.
Okay, and who would that be?
Well, we're talking about none other than Sly Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. We're talking star power here.
Muscle men.
Well, yeah, they do have muscles, but these are like actors first, thespians, Doug. These are true thespians.
Arnold and Sly, thespians.
Well, you laugh if you want, mock me if you will, but, you know, it is the truth. And let's face it, deep down, for example, they've done this before. They branched out.
They tried to branch out before, rather unsuccessfully, as I recall,
Stallone,
David.
Sly Stallone was very, very successful. Well, Rhinestone was a great movie, was it not?
It was not.
Well, okay, it wasn't, but I didn't actually see it, but I heard it was actually pretty good in certain parts.
I saw excerpts of it on TV. It was not a good movie, David.
Well, maybe we saw different parts, but I heard it was pretty good in the parts that I didn't see. Now, the thing is, the other movie, Oscar, won an Oscar, did it not, for Sly Stallone?
I don't believe that the movie Oscar got anywhere near an Oscar, David.
Well, I tell you, I think it's because these two people have branched out to thespian roles, but never together. And now, for the first time, they are doing it together in an amazing property, Doug.
What is this property?
Well, we're talking about none other than the actual role of Sherlock Holmes, Doug. We're talking about the new Sherlock Holmes for the 21st century.
So this is Sly Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger in the traditional roles of Dr. Watson and Sherlock Holmes.
You've hit it on the head, Doug. That's exactly right. We're very excited about this. Really excited.
Which one's going to play Holmes?
Well, you know, there was a big argument about this for a long time, and this is what just been resolved, you know, and they're both so good, you know, but we're gonna have Sly Stallone as Sherlock Holmes and as the assistant Dr. Watson, Schwarzenegger.
We can only imagine how that would go down, David.
Well, Doug, you know, the great thing is you don't have to imagine, because we actually have a clip for you on your show, a real coup here. We're going to give you a little quick
excerpt.
They've
been rehearsing this, have they?
We have. They've been shooting, and they've been doing dry runs and rehearsals, and we got a little clip that you're going to love.
Okay, well.
And I'm really happy to share it with you.
All right, hold on just a second.
Yeah, I don't know how you did it, Holmes. I don't know how you did it.
Tut-tut, Watson. It was a mere trifle.
Yeah, but how did you figure it out?
I figured it out. It was nothing. Get a load of this. I found footprints all over the floor.
Wow, footprints? Really?
Yeah, that's what I said. Footprints. They're all over the place. It was elementary.
You knew mischief was afoot?
Yeah, you said it.
But how the deuce could you be so sure, Holmes?
Hey, I wrote a monograph on this very subject.
A monograph?
If you're hearing impaired, yeah, I said a monograph.
A About what?
Footprints. That's what I'm talking about. Footprints. Jesus.
So what do you think, Doug, huh? What do you think?
David,
pretty amazing, huh?
I'm speechless.
I know, I am too. It's amazing.
I must say, they're not Sir John Gielgud and Sir Ralph Richardson.
Well, you know, if you're trying to say they don't have British accents, yeah, I agree. You know, they're not exactly, you know, British people, they are one of a kind.
How you
can
have American actors playing guys without a British accent?
Well, you know, I mean, this is the American, you know, version of this, you know, British property. I mean, this is the thing that makes it so unique. You know,
aren't you reinventing the wheel?
Well, they're bringing their unique take on this stuff to the role, you know, and they're method actors, Doug. They're just going...
method actors?
They're not trying to change their accents. They're not trying to be something they're not. They're just going with the material and letting it fly.
Well, good luck to you on that, David. We'll talk to you again next week. All right, joining us today is my good friend, former UCD-er, raconteur, Steve Alexander. Welcome back, Steve.
Glad to be here.
Now, last time you told a story, you tantalized our listening audience with the teaser that you were going to tell them how to get out of a ticket.
Oh, the famous serrated parking tickets at the restricted parking lots around the campus.
So as a public service announcement to our listening audience, why don't we tell them how they may perhaps follow in your footsteps and beat a parking ticket?
Okay, very briefly, if you look at, grab your serrated parking ticket, the one that you paid probably $2 for now. It's white in color. It has some red and black numbering and lettering. And in the lower right-hand corner on one of the sides, it will say yellow, blue. It will have a color designation, but you'll notice that the ticket is white.
Actually, they have these at like Sac State, American River College, a lot of the colleges.
Over at the
have
Med
this.
Center, too.
Med
they're,
Center.
They're really big on
UCD
these. And it's a tremendous income producer because what happens to the unsophisticated, as I was after getting 30 or 40 tickets, I noticed that that it had a color designation, but because the ticket looked the same each day, white in color, I figured, hey, how are they going to know that I bought this parking ticket yesterday?
Uh-huh.
And finally discovered that what they did was just trade the rolls each day. With the, one would be have the little blue designation, the little microchip down in the right-hand corner. So anyway, I took one.
So rather than saying red or blue, it had red or blue written.
Exactly. Rather okay. than being red or blue,
oh, yeah.
it had red or blue written.
So I see.
I took it to court, local municipal court there in Davis, in front of, I think it was Judge McGinnis, great guy, and pointed this out and advanced the defense of entrapment, pointing out that the university knows darn well that people like me, if that's possible, were going to be looking at these white tickets thinking, hey, uh-huh. they can't tell the difference. And he actually mm-hmm. threw the ticket out. So it's a good defense. There is some precedent for it. And I recommend, even though, you know, apologies to the university, I know it'll really cut into the parking budget. But that's one way to beat those tickets locally.
Well, smartly done. Did you know you were destined for law school when you went into the challenge the court system in your Don Quixote-like fashion?
No, not at all. It was a matter of finances. I, of course, was on my own except for tuition and books. So it was a matter of survival.
How do you mean?
Well, I would have to pay for all my tickets. I had 20 or 30 of them stacking up every month, you know, because I'd always miss that omnibus, and uh-huh. I'd have to drive to campus.
You realize now that freshmen are not allowed, I believe, at UCU. They recommend strongly they do not bring automobiles to their first year of college.
Well, having having children in college at this point, I wholeheartedly embrace that policy.
Now, your son, Adam, is starting in the fall, so we need to bring him on.
Yeah,
on
we'll
the show.
We'll have to get him on the show.
Perhaps next week.
Yeah, that'd be great. I know he would enjoy it.
Anyway, let's tell a story now that I think will amuse our audience about what another one of your initiatives that you took in the freshman year, which left us, I must say, left those of us who observed you up to these antics in awe of what you attempted.
Well, two things. First of all, I don't find the story amusing, and it was not an antic. I guess the sad part is I was dead serious about it. And, of course, you're referring to contacting Kurt Vonnegut, the famous author.
Well, set it up. Set it up properly here. You're in English class.
Okay. I was in, I think I had passed Bonehead English and was actually in a, you know, a literature English class, and we were reading as part of the curriculum. Slaughterhouse Five, uh-huh. About the bombing of Dresden. And we got in a big debate in one of our sections, you know, arguing over what the book meant and, You know, was it a history book?
Various symbolisms.
Various symbolisms.
As people always argue, what does this mean?
Yes, is it merely a metaphor? Uh-huh. You know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And what do you suppose the white whale means?
Right. Yeah. So I you know, queried the class, well, why don't we just, like, call Mr. Vonnegut and ask him, okay? And, of course, everybody chuckled, and the TA looked at me with a disapproving glance. You know, do not do that. And I thought, hey, why not go to the source? So I did a little research. And actually located...
Off the back of the book, I believe.
Well, no, I went to the book of Who's Who and looked up Kurt Vonnegut, found out that he lived in, I think it was Barnes Stable, Massachusetts. I called around, believe it or not. There's a little bit of a believe it or not in this story. I was able to get his phone number, apparently the phone number to his apartment in Manhattan, where he was away working. I guess he lived in Barnes Stable when he was on holiday.
And thought, why not follow up?
Yeah, so I dialed the number. I think I got his uncle or cousin or something. He said, sure, call Kurt in Manhattan. Well, I think the guy was a shrimper or a lobsterman or something. So we started talking shellfish, and then I finally got the guy's number. So I called and you know, got him mid-morning, because I'm sure I didn't call him before you know, 8 o'clock our time. And he answered the phone.
You should also mention the fact that you did have a tape recorder running.
I ran a tape, did not knowing it was a misdemeanor to record someone in California. I figured it's not illegal in New York, so if he's there, I could record him. So in any event, I called, and he answered the phone. I said, is this Kurt Vonnegut? He said, yes. And I think I said, Kurt with a K, yes, and, you know, confirmed that it was him.
As opposed to Kurt with a C, Vonnegut?
Yes, right. And so I just told him that there was a little bit of a white lie in there. I told him I was a graduate student doing research, and that, you know, among my colleagues, there was a discussion about the book, and wanted to ask him a few questions.
He greeted us with some hostility, as I recall.
Let me just say this, he wasn't very responsive, open, candid, or enthused. Yeah, and I asked him some, you know, what I thought was a deep question at the time, like, well, the bombing of Dresden, is it like a metaphor, or is it truly about the, you know, is it because we didn't like the figurines, we thought we could truly only win the war that way, or is it a metaphor for, you know, the cruelty of mankind? And he said something that was...
Well, Nessie, now, you don't remember this, but I quite distinctly remember you playing the tape for the rest of us, because you had pulled off this accomplishment of getting him on the phone. And you're asking him, what did you mean when such and such, which he sort of cuts you up and says, look, I wrote the book because I wrote the book, not so you could tear it apart in English class.
Right. And, of course, I thanked him, told him that was very, that was helpful, and that I would carry the message back to my colleagues. And of course, I did take the tape back to the class, and they were all wowed, and the TA still looked at me with a disapproving glance. That was it. That's Kurt Vonnegut's story. I don't find it very amusing. I was dead serious at the time, only in later life to realize how silly and presumptuous
I
was.
Well, you know, when I watched, what was that, Rodney Dangerfield movie, Back to School, and basically he goes out and hires Kurt Vonnegut to write his term paper, I thought of you.
Never caught that one. Did Kurt Vonnegut make a cameo?
Yes, he did.
Really? How'd he look?
I believe he did. He looks good. Hmm. He spoke right here in Sacramento just a few years ago. Certainly worth hearing.
Well,
very
he's a very
interesting man.
A minor author, but...
I wonder if people still read Vonnegut.
I think they should be required to. I still haven't figured out what the bombing of Dresden means.
Well, you know what? I don't know whether people are reading him or not, but let's take a moment and do a little
excerpt. Is he still living?
Yes, he is.
We should give him a call. I still have his number.
Good God. Let's do a quick quote from Kurt Vonnegut's God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. Mushari recalled what his favorite professor, Leonard Leach, once told him about getting ahead in law. Leach said that just as a good airplane pilot should always be looking for places to land, so should a lawyer be looking for situations where large amounts of money were about to change hands. In every big transaction, said Leach, there's a magic moment during which a man has surrendered a treasure, and during which the man who's due to receive it has not yet done so. An alert lawyer will make that moment his own, possessing the treasure for a magic microsecond, taking a little of it, passing it on. If the man who is to receive the treasure is unused to wealth, has an inferiority complex, and shapeless feelings of guilt, as most people do, the lawyer can often take as much as half the bundle and still receive the recipient's blubbering thanks. You know, I got to tell you, back in college days, I was inspired by the fact that you'd already been out and getting flying lessons. And a couple years later, I went out and started at the Cal Aggie Flying Farmers, and... after a 20-year gap, finally actually got a pilot's license, having delayed it for other things. But How come you never went ahead and got a license?
Well, I actually gave it up about the time I got to Davis. I learned to fly in the Bay Area and soloed on my 16th birthday. And by the time I got to Davis...
Very impressive to all the kids in high school, by the way.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that difficult. But I was involved in sports at Davis and, you know, politics and, of course, trying to pass. I was calling Kurt Vonnegut a lot, so I had to give up flying. But I learned to fly down in the Bay Area back when you know, there was really no... what they call a TCA, I guess, what they used to call a terminal control area. We could just fly around the Bay Area really without much interference.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a little dangerous at the age of 14 and a half flying around. With
well, you started at 14 and a half?
Yeah, I just took lessons when I was 14 and a half.
Oh, man.
And you could solo on your 16th birthday. So by the time I was 16, I had like 47 hours.
Wow.
In a small aircraft. And
yeah.
Most people solo after like 10 hours, but I just wasn't old enough. So I soloed on my 16th birthday and then...
People do not solo after 10 hours. Some people may solo after 10 hours.
Well, I think people, well, I guess. I don't know. I've always heard 10 to 15 hours people solo. But in any event, I soloed on my 16th birthday and flew around the Bay Area a lot and took some cross-country flights and then eventually
gave it up. As I recall, you had a little adventure in one of your cross-countries.
A couple of adventures.
Why don't you tell us a little about that?
My instructor and I were on a cross-country flight preparing me to do a solo cross-country.
Uh-huh.
So we were flying from Hayward to, I think we flew to Modesto, landed there, took off. We were going to go to the Nut Tree, which has a nice little airport.
Yeah. Flew in last week. Very nice.
Yeah, and then back to Hayward. And my instructor, you know, he had like 20,000 hours and, uh-huh. you know, could fly with his eyes closed, literally. But anyway, he used to fake, you know, being asleep. Of course, back then you could smoke in these planes, too. So, you know, he'd have a Salem and and look around and just let me fly as if I was flying alone. So we were headed
from...
On your
cross-country, you have to mark where you are and show that you can navigate, yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. So we were flying up the valley at about probably 5,000 feet in the valley haze, you know, with the inversion. It was... You really couldn't see that far.
Uh-huh.
And my instructor was either asleep or pretending he was asleep, and I'm flying along and doing my dead reckoning navigation with my little computer, my little hand computer, like a slide rule.
The instructor slumped down,
in his right seat, and you know, it's really uneventful until I look to the left and down about, I don't want to exaggerate, I mean, it may be a couple hundred feet, maybe 300 feet. I looked down, and there was a large United Airlines who knows what it was? I guess back then it might have been a 707. Just passed right under me in the other direction. And I of course, got that warm feeling. You ever had that warm feeling, you know, like you might wet yourself during a test where you don't know the answer? I had that warm feeling, and then, of course, that passed.
So he's going about five times your speed.
I'm tooting along
100 yards away?
Yeah, maybe 100 yards. Yeah, maybe 300 feet in the opposite direction.
No.
Oh, yeah, he was going towards Stockton, and I was in between Stockton and Sacramento. So it was just a flash. I mean, and of course, I'm supposed to.
So you're going about 100, and he's going about 500, so you're 600 miles an
hour. I'm going 75. I'm in a Cessna 150. I'm barely going.
Okay, but still, he's probably going. So you're closing at like basically
575 miles an hour.
So, you know, a mile in 10 seconds.
Yeah. And it was
so he goes
sort of
being a mile away to where you are in 10 seconds.
Yeah, and of course you and I were talking earlier off the air about ethics and always doing the right, you know, doing the right thing. And I looked over my instructor and I thought, you know, definitely doing the right thing. It's not waking him up at this point. So we went
You thought you might not draw his attention to what had just transpired.
Yeah, and it was really lucky that I wasn't soloing that day, because when we got to the Nut Tree, there was about a 20-knot crosswind.
Oh, that's always nice.
And I lined up for the landing, and I was dipping my wing. I don't know if it was a skid or a slip or whatever. It's a maneuver to buck the crosswind and make sure
to stay straight.
Right, to stay straight and make sure you hit the runway and not the grassy area.
That's important.
You're on the rough. And there were a bunch of people sitting at the observation deck, which was about, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 yards from the side of the runway. They had a nice gazebo out there. And at the very last minute, I guess I lifted the wingtip up a little much, and I was blown over directly towards the observation deck. And, of course, by that time, my instructor was awake. took over the controls, and we just flew on.
So you basically buzzed over the top of the observation deck at what, 30 feet maybe?
Yeah, totally. It was, it's very, very frightening.
I'm sure that caused people to spill their margaritas.
I don't know what they were drinking. They were dressed nicely. Probably waiting for a flight. But anyway, raises a good point because of this midair, you know, over in Europe. I'm not sure you want to go into that. But the only interesting part about that midair collision, aside from being horribly tragic, is that apparently we are going to have the same separation rules and their flight control system, traffic control system, I think in 2003. They're reducing the separation between aircraft.
Well,
because there are so many aircraft that need to be vectored in and out of major airports.
I mean, right now you should have if you're flying east or west, you should be, you know, 2,000-foot intervals so that people going the opposite direction are 1,000 feet. So you should have 1,000 feet above or below.
They're lowering it to 1,000 feet separation in commercial aircraft. So we can pick that up. Maybe we can get an airline captain on the show.
Yeah, we may want to talk about some of that.
I'm thinking the train's looking better and better. You know, you pick up that train in Sacramento, boom, you're in the Bay Area in a couple hours. You're on the ground. That's a good thing.